Good morning. Good morning. How is everyone? All right. My name is Fred Humphreys, and I'm Vice President of U.S. Government Affairs, and it's my pleasure to introduce you, welcome you to the Microsoft Innovation and Policy Center. And I think we got a great at Microsoft forum for today. We're here to talk about the Internet of Things, which is, quite frankly, in its early infancy as we think about networking physical objects on the Internet. And, you know, you think about some little things, you know, Microsoft being a cross-platform company. I thought I'd wear today my Fitbit as opposed to my Microsoft band, but, you know, aspect. But what it can detect, I'm now an early riser because I'm trying to be fit, and so, you know, it gets all the different information on my steps and things of that nature. But when you think about all these sensors and all these things that are out there that have the ability, and when you think about the Internet of Things, to collect information, and then you think about things like SQL Server and Azure, which is cloud, which be able to analyze and convert that data into ambient intelligence, and how do you use that information, then it results in you having to think about something that's very, very important, privacy and security. And that's something that you're going to hear from a great panel today with an outstanding moderator, because I'm on his board. I really like the guy, and Rob Atkinson, who will moderate. But my real job today is really to introduce Senator Heller from the great state of Nevada. He's one that you all may or may not know. Microsoft has a presence there. We have employees, a decent number of employees in Reno. But most importantly, Senator Heller has been one that's been great on many public policy issues, from the Immigration Innovation Act, I-Square, to FCC transparency and reform, as well as the LEADS Act. But I think what's most important when I think about Senator Heller, we have something that's kind of in common. In my workout today, because it's Senator Heller Day, I had my USC, University of Southern California, fight on gym aspect. Not because I'm a USC grad, but my son is at USC right now in his third year, and the senator is from the university, graduate of the University of Southern California. In addition, which makes me cool, my son's kind of into art and graphics and the whole thing. His son is a Vine rock star. I'm actually not joking. Go to Vine. Was just there in my office looking at Vine. Harris Heller. Harris Heller. Check it out. Neat stuff. And he's Vine famous. And it's really, really cool stuff. It looks a lot like you too, Senator. but the senator being on the Commerce Committee is had a hearing when it comes to the Internet of Things, and is really has a strong interest. And so with that, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Senator Dean Heller.
This mic is on. It will work. Sorry for those on the other side of the room. I apologize. I'll pick this thing up and move it if you want me to. At 9:30, I have to be down on the floor. I'm responsible for opening the floor up, so we don't have a lot of time. And I don't want to miss that. One, McConnell won't be happy with me. Two, very, very rarely am I called Mr. President. So I hate to miss that opportunity also. So anyway, I'll make my comments. I don't like to speak for a long period of time anyway, just to touch on a few issues, but more importantly, make sure that we get your questions and concerns answered. I'll tell you, last night, most of us, you know, who live far away from home, we generally call our spouse and let them know we're going to bed and all's well. And she says, "What are you doing tomorrow?" I says, "I've got to give a speech over at Microsoft building." And she says, "Well, what are you talking on?" I said, "Internet of Things." She said, "What?" I said, "The Internet of Things." She still didn't get it. "What?" things, you know, like thing one, thing two. Oh, Internet of Things. She says those words don't make any sense. So you can imagine how difficult it is to explain that to your constituents if you can't convince your wife that it's actually three words that go together. So we're working hard on that, and we'll see if we can make sense. If I can convince my wife, maybe I'll have a chance to convince the rest of my constituents. There's a lot of words, you know, that you put together. I hope that it makes sense. You know, you can take these odd words like Internet of Things, like flying cars. I like that idea. How about Duke versus Kentucky? Being from Nevada, take the points. How about Governor Sandoval for Senate? I don't know if any of you are from Nevada and recognize a big race going on in Nevada this year. The words I like the most that you can combine that don't mean anything without them being combined, and that's a senior senator from Nevada. I like the ring of that also. Anyway, needless to say, maybe only the Republicans here in the room appreciate that. But needless to say, in the next, this is the week, the day, and the hour where we're going to find out whether or not Republicans can govern. We have our Votorama, and hopefully within the next 24 hours, I anticipate I won't sleep for the next 24 hours, we'll be voting on the Senate floor
that will actually pass a budget. For the first time in 6 years, we're hoping that the United States Senate will actually pass a budget. And if we can't, we prove that we're no better than the other side. So it's an opportunity for a Republican-controlled Senate for the first time in many years to prove that they can govern. And we'll know that, so be aware of that. Internet things, to me, is important. But at the end of the day, proving that the Republican Party can actually govern by passing a budget by tomorrow morning, I think has more to do with my future, near future, than anything else. A few weeks ago, the Senate Commerce Committee held a hearing on this topic of Internet of Things. And I showed everyone there a Microsoft band that monitors a lot of things. It wasn't my band. It was my staff's band. But he handed it to me, and I could get a lot of detail from this guy. I can tell whether or not he worked out that day, and he hadn't. I could tell if he was eating good food or junk food, and he was eating junk food. I could tell what his heart rate was. I could tell how he slept that night before, what zone he was in, and at what hour of the night. A lot of information on this guy. But I think that's interesting. And the question is, should it's a lot of private information and a lot of information that's important to him. But the question is who else gets to see this information? So if you can download it on an app on your phone, is it just your information or is it someone else's information? Fred, in his introduction, talked about my kids. And it's true. I can download the Vine app. In fact, I have the Vine app on here, and I can push Vine, and I can go right to my kids and see them on Vine. And the question is that information that I put in order to get that app, what do you do with it? And what does Vine do with it? If you look at what they do, it's pretty clear that they know Vine knows what to do with the information that they get from people like myself who download their app. My children advertise for Chrysler on Vine now. So clearly Chrysler knows enough about you and those who have the Vine app to determine it's in their best interest to advertise on that platform. Coca-Cola, they advertise for Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has determined by the information simply by downloading that app, and there are probably... I'd hate to guess 50, 60 million Americans that have that Vine app. So Coca-Cola, Starbucks, clothing companies, they advertise for all of them. But the reason they do so is that all these companies realize and recognize the data that's available. So I think it's great. I think it's wonderful that we have this kind of technology, and Microsoft obviously is the forefront of all this. But there is another side to this, and a side that we need to talk about, that we will be talking about here in Congress, and that's privacy. So here's the questions. Should information be taken? And I doubt they'd sell an app or let you download an app without information. But if so, when and what is taken? Next question is then what to do with it. You can keep going. The next question is, do you sell it? Who do you sell it to? What are they using it for? And should they be allowed to sell it? These are all the questions that we're trying to decide. While it's in your protection, or his fitband is in his possession, how does he protect that information? If you have access to this data, what happens if it's breached? Who do you tell? And when do you tell them? So these fundamental questions and others are what we focused on last year when I served as the ranking member on the Consumer Protection Subcommittee on Commerce. And now we're grappling with it again. I think there are many sides as to whether or not there are laws that are going to be necessary to protect. On one hand, there's a lot of data. Some do not understand the transactional nature of the internet. You may not be paying with money for websites, applications, but you are paying for that information, and you're paying for that information with your data. If collection ability is curbed, then what will it take to make money? Money-making ability, and will it ultimately harm innovation if you can no longer trade and sell this data? So understand the push and pull here, and I will make just a couple of observations. One is, we must be careful. It's probably a good idea to apply the principles of do no harm, the idea that we try to grapple with in the United States Senate. If we decide to move forward, we should have simple criteria as to what we're addressing. And let me suggest the two criteria. First is what harm actually exists and what harms need to be addressed. Not hypothetical, but I want actual harms. And two, how is that harm not addressed? By the marketplace or by current laws that we already have in existence? And these two questions, I think, cut straight to the chase of what we're trying to do here in Washington, D.C. If concerns arise over the massive amounts of data being collected or the business practices of companies engaging in all points of the data marketplace, then anyone coming to me asking for my vote to legislate must tell me those two things. Is there actual harm? And how is this harm not addressed currently in the marketplace or by current law? By the way, if an issue comes up that is harmful to consumers, isn't already addressed adequately, I'm confident that many, if not everybody here in this room, would want that legislative fix. So this is where I stop, because I want to be called Mr. President this morning. And if I don't hurry up and get down to that floor, someone else will be called Mr. President this morning. So I want to thank everybody for what you do. I hope you understand that there's a lot of us that are grappling with the very issues that you have in front of you. There are a lot of Americans that make money off the internet. A lot of money. I bet you there's 10 million Americans that make money off the internet, and my children are two of them. Two of them. In fact, they're doing so well that they dropped out of school. I'm not happy with that. And they quit their jobs. They were both working for Apple at the time. But they knew they could make more money on the internet than they could working for a company, a large company like that. And sure enough, they've proven old dad wrong. I mean, I rolled my eyes. This was 10 months ago. 10 months ago, they decided to go online with their talents. And now they've been on The View, and now they're advertising for a multiple set of companies because of the talents that they have. And it is incredible. I'm concerned. I will tell you I'm concerned, and that's why I have produced FCC reform. And I want the actions that are being taken by this FCC that I think is detrimental. I think it's very detrimental to the innovation and everything that you guys stand for. I think it's very, very detrimental. My biggest fear and concern was the fact that they put all these new regulations in place. Not one of us in this room got to look at it before it was voted for, before it was voted on. Can you imagine that this day and age? All that information is available out there. Not anybody here in this room got an idea of what the FCC was doing on net neutrality until after they took the vote. And I think that's a shame. And that's what my FCC reform is all about. I want more light on the subject. I want more information available to you. I want more information available to this Congress before bureaucrats make those kind of decisions. So I'm going to move forward. John Thune does a great job, by the way, chairman of that committee. He's got legislation. He's going to grab a bunch of mine, and I'm okay with that. I put together a manager's amendment, and I'm hoping that we can move forward. This net neutrality law that we saw, I think, will be in the courts for the next 4 or 5 years. Probably, I'm guessing the FCC will lose, but it'll be a setback because it'll put some uncertainty in the marketplace. And the amount of dollars and capital and speed that we have in this country, and to try to think that we're going to take our internet and make it just like Europe, where we start treating it like a utility, will reduce the speed and reduce the investments that companies like this have put over the last 2 decades into the internet. So I think there are some bright spots, and we're going to continue to move forward. I know Thune will work hard. I'll work hard. But what I want is a free, open internet. And I have real problems to thinking that we need to regulate this kind of freedom. And it has been for the last 2 decades. Real, true freedom in this country. So anyway, thank you for having me here. Thank you for everything that you do.
Okay, well, good morning, everyone. We're going to jump into the policy substance of IoT and privacy now. So I want to introduce our four panelists here. I'm Rob Atkinson. I'm president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. This is an area we've been working on for a long, long time. Daniel Castro from ITIF just testified in House Commerce on Tuesday. And we've written a number of reports, both through ITIF and our affiliated Center for Data Innovation. So we have four great panels. We're going to do this as a somewhat informal conversation, and we should have plenty of time to engage you all with your comments or questions. And I'm just going to do very quick intros on going right down from my left. Brendan Lynch is the Chief Privacy Officer at Microsoft, and he has responsibilities for all of Microsoft's privacy program, including the privacy policy, privacy by design, and data protection technologies, and has been involved in this space for a long, long, long time. I've known Brendan for, must be eight, nine years now, and he's also on the board of directors of the International Association of Privacy Professionals. Jeff Farah is the counsel on Senate Commerce Committee on Commerce on Science and Transportation, where he advises Senator Thune on communications, internet, and tech policy, internet policy. Prior to that, he was general counsel to Senator Scott Brown and has a long, long background in this space. Mark Eichhorn is the Assistant Director, Division of Privacy and Identity Protection at the Bureau of Consumer Protection at the FTC. And he joined that bureau in 2009 from Chairman John Leibowitz's office is a lawyer graduate from Yale University. And finally, Yael Weinman, who is Vice President of Public Policy, Global Privacy Policy, at the Information Technology Industry Council. She focuses on a whole set of issues around privacy, and including in the global space. And prior to that, she was 10 years at the Federal Trade Commission, most recently as an attorney advisor to Commissioner Brill. So, Brendan, I want to start with you. And I think one of the problems with this space is, as Senator Heller alluded to, what is it? And then secondly, and really what I want to ask you is, how should we think about this space differently than the kind of the whole sort of internet privacy space we've been thinking about for 15 years, which is really about getting on a computer, putting something in the computer, and seeing what happens to it? IoT is sort of related to that, but in a lot of ways it's not related to that. Oftentimes there's no screen. How do we think about privacy? What are the similarities in IoT and privacy and security? What are the differences?
Yeah. Well, thank you, and thank you for moderating this panel. I think, you know, to the first part, what is it? There are, I think, you know, a lot of definitions, and we heard from the senator earlier about, you know, confusion about what Internet of Things really is. And I think that's partially because it's in its infancy, and it's hard to sort of grasp where things are going. One way I think about it is it's a digitization of the physical world, right? So, and it's not necessarily the Internet of Things, or that's a very broad when you think about all sorts of devices that today are not internet connected, but in future will be. It's sort of helpful to break it down to various zones. Like there's the internet of the body, you know, with wearables, and most people would think that's the most personal of the internets of things. But then there's also the internet of the home, the internet of the workplace, public transportation, public spaces. You know, they're all going to have this digitization in varying ways, and there'll be varying degrees of interaction and control that individuals have around that. To your point about, you know, how is it different? I think in a lot of ways it doesn't need to be thought of and treated differently from a protection standpoint for security and privacy. I think we've over time, you know, there's been all sorts of technologies introduced as humans have progressed, and we've always found a way to apply core principles to those. The Internet of Things, though, what's different, I think, is the ubiquity and the pervasiveness of it, you know, the fact that there's going to be so many data points, and many of those data points will relate to individuals, that I think makes it different and need to be looked at a little differently is the sheer volume. And as I mentioned, it'll be a lot of that data people will think of as very personal. You know, people today are thinking of data that relates to them as an extension of themselves, and increasingly as we move to that world, we're going to have to recognize that fact. But ultimately what's needed is, I believe, to look at how we've built trust around other technologies in the past and think about what's different and define what the trust framework looks like for the Internet of Things. And for me, it comes back to core principles. You know, there's going to be the need for security. You know, one of the one way of thinking of building trust is an equation we use. Trust equals security times privacy times value. And that's a way to kind of really understand the balance.
Isn't
of
it the inverse of value?
No,
more
I
valuable,
think
you're
I believe no.
Higher risk?
Trust value is a part of the trust equation. So, if, and I say security times privacy times value, meaning that if any one of those three things is zero, then trust is zero, and it's a part of the value equation because people expect when they're giving their information to a third party that they're going to receive some value in return, and so if that value exchange is absent, then that erodes trust. But surely also. So inadequate security or privacy measures would also erode
wouldn't
that.
You, maybe there's a fourth variable, which is sort of risk of the information. I don't really care whether somebody knows that, you know, I walk to school right. or something like that, but I might care if somebody knows I'm taking a particular medicine. And so
right. Right.
That would seem to be another factor here, that certain things are just so low risk, low that you don't
yes.
sort of care about them as much. And I mean, it's sort of why we have... higher standards for health through HIPAA. That was
right.
the logic.
Exactly. And I think this is the same. That's one of the principles of how do we take a risk-based approach here. We've got tools in our toolbox. You know, we think of, as a privacy professional, as a chief privacy officer, a big focus is what is the risk to our customers and how do we adequately address that. In the security world, there's the concepts of threat modeling, and there's going to be a range of new threats to model and then mitigate those risks. But that's a key part of it, but it's also the time-tested values of transparency. You know, that's a part of empowering people is ensuring that people understand what data is being collected, how it's being used. It's control, and especially control where it's most meaningful, as you point out. You know, the more sensitive data or the more risk of harm, the controls need to be commensurate with that. De-identification, I think, is going to be important here. There is probably many scenarios where we can derive the value of Internet of Things and all of the data that comes from it, in a way that is not necessarily individually identifiable, because a lot of the benefits can be societal when you look at the vast data sets that will be generated as the Internet of Things progresses.
I want to come back to that because I was just in Europe last week, and there's a sort of generalized meme in Europe that de-identification is impossible. But I don't want to go there yet. I just want to ask you one more question, and that's a lot of this, as you alluded to, is going to be de-identified in the first place. Like I think, for example, Street Bump in Boston, which is a really really great little app that Code for America, I think, developed with the city. And what it is, you can sign up for your phone, any of the platforms, and when your car goes over a bump, your accelerometer in the phone notices that, and it sends a little signal to the city public works department so they know where the bumps are in the road, and they can go out and fix the potholes. They don't care if it's me or Brendan. They don't take the PII from the phone. They just say, a phone was here, and it went over a bump. And I think a lot of things are able to do that, and we need to differentiate in the debate between those kinds of things and versus a Fitbit where they know that it is me.
Exactly. I think that's a part of the approach, and that's the doing the risk and benefit trade-off and picking the right tools for the job, and de-identification will often be that. But then there are other scenarios where it does need to be personally attributable. That's how it will get the value, because it's to be able to communicate back to me something of value. And so there's also going to be scenarios, I think, where a lot of ability to observe and predict behavior is going to be there and down to the individual level. And we're going to need other protections around that. There's going to be the need for some use limitations that, you know, the data cannot be used for certain uses. So I think there's a number of principles. We've had them before. We've applied them to prior technologies and evolutions, and we'll just need to continue to do that.
Great. Yael, we were talking earlier, and you look a lot around the world at what countries are doing in the IoT space, Asia, Europe, or the sort of two major constellations, if you will, besides us. And can you talk a little bit about how other countries or regions are looking at this? Because there's really kind of two values, and I don't want to say they're in contradiction, because they're not, but perhaps it's sort of what you stress. There's the one value of, man, we just want this IoT thing because it's going to improve health and transportation, environment, all of this stuff, versus we're a little afraid of this. So can you talk a little bit how countries are looking at those trade-offs, and then maybe where you think we lie in that continuum?
Thanks, Rob, and thanks, everyone, for coming today, and thanks to Microsoft. It's a great question, Rob, and I've made some observations in looking at how some other countries are approaching the Internet of Things and kind of comparing that to the general discussion about data and privacy. And I think with the Internet of Things, we have an opportunity to, in a lot of ways, do a reset in our conversation about privacy and data security, because here we have the recognition of the tremendous benefits that can come with the Internet of Things. We are wearing them. I can know that my son's school bus is on its way. To me, that's a real benefit, rather than just standing at the bus stop and not knowing whether it's going to come at all. So the benefits are much more tangible to us as individuals than they were, or when they are today, when you're sitting in front of your computer and not really having a greater sense of the ecosystem. But I think with the Internet of Things, there's a greater understanding of the tremendous benefits. But when we look at policies that are developing around the world, you see in some economies like India, and you look at Korea, they are really excited about the Internet of Things. They are putting out policies and position papers. How can we reap the benefits of the Internet of Things? They are mindful of privacy and security and appreciate that those things need to be at the forefront. Privacy by design, security by design, privacy engineering, those types of solutions. But we're seeing in Europe, the initial reactions are fearful. The initial reactions are, well, what about privacy? What about security? Of course, those are important considerations, and those need to be discussed right at the forefront, but those need to be discussed not in isolation. Obviously, those need to be discussed in conjunction with the policy framework for the Internet of Things. So, here in the United States, I think we have a real opportunity, and I'm looking to Jeff here because he's down the street on the Hill where a lot of opportunities lie, to make the case that this is an important policy area. We can't be rushing to legislate in this area without really knowing yet how the framework will emerge. So I think here in the United States, we have an opportunity to show how privacy and security need to be considered right at the forefront, but they need to be considered alongside a lot of other issues relating to the Internet of Things, like interoperability, like standards, like spectrum, all other considerations that we need to be thinking about as well.
So I want to come back to that sort of international question and sort of who might lead in this space, but you had a segue into Jeff. And Jeff, Senate Commerce held a hearing, I think, in January or February?
February.
On IoT, and a number of witnesses talk about this, and then soon after that, Senators Iote, Booker, Fisher, and Schatz released a resolution, a Senate resolution that, among other things, called for the U.S. to develop a national strategy for IoT. I want to quote one part from it because I think it's a great resolution that we tweeted and endorsed or supported. It says, whereas the United States should strive to be a world leader in smart cities and smart infrastructure to ensure its businesses and citizens in both rural and urban parts of the country have access to the safest and most resilient communities in the world. So it's very much I don't want to make it sound more of an Asian approach, kind of more of a, this is going to be great. How do we do it, as opposed to more of a let's slow down here. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the thinking of the committee and Senator Thune on why you did the hearing? Where might you be going with this?
Sure. I think that Senator Heller in his remarks really typifies the way in which a lot of the members, and I mean that on a bipartisan basis, are thinking about the Internet of Things. It's a major technological trend. It has great promise for American consumers and businesses. But at the same time, there are serious challenges. And we were thinking about these challenges in terms of three main buckets: connectivity, privacy, and security. And on connectivity, it's something that a lot of the members of our committee, including my boss, the chairman, Senator Thune, who's from South Dakota, are from very rural areas. And so we'll have to get these connectivity questions right, because the reality is that we don't have ubiquitous Wi-Fi in many rural areas. We don't have outstanding cellular coverage. And so these will present challenges that our committee looks to tackle in the future. And then, of course, on privacy and security, a lot of these are becoming better understood. A lot of them are addressed in the FTC staff report on the subject. But I think that one of the really great things about our hearing was that while a lot of people understand the Internet of Things to be about items that are in our home or what we wear on ourselves, the hearing talked a lot about how there are applications on the American farm, there are industrial applications, and so the members really got up to speed on how this is going to be pervasive in American society.
Yeah, no, I know we wrote about one years ago, and it was sensors on wineries, on vineyards, where they have sensors on the vines, and they know what the temperature is, or they know what the humidity is, and really, really improves their ability to manage those kinds of things. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We'll see it in, we'll see it in sewer pipes. We'll see it in garbage cans. Yeah. Well, it's just it'll be everywhere. Jeff, you alluded to the FTC staff report, so I want to turn to Mark. The FTC released a staff report in January, Internet of Things, Privacy and Security in a Connected World, and among other things, the report called for baseline privacy legislation, which would go beyond IoT. Everything would be wrapped up into that, including IoT. Can you talk a little bit, maybe sort of the major findings and recommendations of the staff report and where you think it may go?
Sure. So so we held a workshop about a year before the report, and a workshop sort of a conference where we brought in academics and industry members and consumer groups and experts. Vince Cerf was there, and somebody from NSF was there, and basically discussed the privacy and security implications of the technology as well as the benefits. And what was interesting in the panels was, for one thing, I thought a pretty surprising consensus about the sort of need for security and kind of the immaturity of security currently for a lot of these products of data security. And so I just said data security, but it's not actually just data security. For example, you have internet-connected locks, or you have internet-connected garage door openers or security systems. And I think it was just within the last month or so, a group at HP came out with a study that talked about, they'd looked at 10 home security systems, IoT connected, and basically said, you know, 100% security fail was the sort of subheading for the their review of those products. So there's a lot of security concerns. There's also privacy concerns that relate to, as Brendan said, sort of this possibility of sort of massive collection over time of information that can sort of, again, make de-identification a bit more difficult, but also provide a much more comprehensive look at an individual's sort of activities. So, you know, in the report, you know, we basically, as Rob said, we didn't come out and suggest IoT-specific legislation. I mean, we recognized the huge benefits in this space. I mean, I think consumers are a lot excited about a lot of these products and definitely want the benefits. But we kind of tried to urge, you know, privacy by design, security by design. For example, the app that Rob mentioned where you can report the potholes, I mean, that's a great innovation. And it doesn't necessarily happen that easily to do it in a way where you're not collecting that information in an anonymous way. I mean, it takes some effort and thought to do it that way. So, you know, we recommended, again, you know, better privacy practices, better security practices, and ways to provide notice to consumers and sort of meaningful choices.
Great. So I know there was some minority responses on the FTC report, but I want to drill down into two questions on that, and anybody can jump in, not just Mark. But one was around the area we were had some perhaps disagreements about was the notion of data minimization. I'll read a quote from the report. It says, second, if a company collects and retains large amounts of data, there is an increased risk the data will be used in a way that departs from consumers' reasonable expectations. And I guess our view is that misses what IoT is all about in a way, or minimized. IoT is about two things in our view. It's sort of like part of what Brendan was talking about. It's about, you know, just the thing doing what it's supposed to do in real time. You know, telling the farmer that their crops don't have enough water, letting you open your door when you're from your car, letting you monitor your weight or your thing. That's sort of in real time. But the second part of it is around learning from all of that data. You look at a company like Nest, for example. If all Nest were doing was to let me monitor my thermostat at home, I have a Nest thermostat, it would be kind of cool. But what Nest is also doing is they're taking all of that data, and they're doing data analytics around energy. And they are providing very important insights into how people use energy, and it's going to allow sort of transformation or change in our energy system. And you can just see that over and over and over again, that the analysis of data is very, very important, whether it's in healthcare and the learning we're going to get from that. And I guess I would just sort of say that the framing of this is perhaps not the right way. The framing is about consumers' reasonable expectations, but I'm not only a consumer, but I'm a citizen. And as a citizen, I have reasonable expectations that we're going to continue to innovate in healthcare, and we're going to continue to innovate in energy. And I'm willing, as a citizen, just like I vote, and voting is sort of irrational when you think about it. No election's ever been decided by one vote. I vote because it's a civic duty. And I sort of look at my data being out there for analysis as my civic duty. Now, to be fair, I don't, you know, I want to make sure there's controls, it's de-identified, it's not abused. But isn't there a risk that data minimization is going to reduce the pool, if you will, of data analytics. And I'll let Brandon do that after you, Mark.
So. Yeah. I think that I would say no for a variety of reasons. I mean, for one thing, we talked about a lot of the sort of caveats to data minimization. One of them would be de-identification. So if you're using it, you know, in a de-identified way and you're drawing conclusions based on the de-identified data, you know, that's something that's fine. But I think at some point this argument gets into and we also talked about use of data for, again, purposes that are consistent with the, you know, what the consumer would have expected. So when you're talking about uses that are not consistent with what the consumer would have expected, that's really where the problem comes down to, and where you're talking about personal data, not de-identified data. So for example, in our Google Buzz case, Google had provided Gmail and collected information, was providing email services to people, and had made certain representations about, you know, the use of their email address, and then decided to start the Google Buzz, you know, social network using that information, and in doing so, you know, repurposed people's email addresses and sort of made them public in that way. So you're talking about some basically unexpected use of information in a new way, and I feel like if you want to, you know, use information in a new way, you can usually get consent from people who want that to happen. So I think we were very open to, you know, sort of pro-social uses of data.
Brendan, you wouldn't want to comment on a Google case. Do you want to actually comment on the question of data minimization, and can you go too far? Because actually, I read the report as saying you should delete data. You shouldn't. There's a difference between storing a large amount of it and then making sure you're very careful with using it versus deleting it. You don't know. Maybe in 3 years, boy, you're going to find a new use for that that's consistent with privacy and other things. So, Brendan, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think. Well, I do think first of all that data minimization is as a useful principle to have in the mix. And there are going to be scenarios where, I think people experience this already, and this gets back to the user expectation context, but people have a weird reaction when they realize that their flashlight app on their phone is wanting to know their real-time location. And it just feels out of context and not expected. There are some examples like that where collecting everything will just not fly because it will not work for people from a trust perspective overall. But I think that things like de-identification and retention timeframes do come into the fray. And it may be that it's identified for a period of time that it can legitimately provide value back to you. Comparing your energy uses with those in your community and, you know, giving you that data. But maybe as it ages over time, it's less important to keep that data from 3 years ago connected exactly to you, but you still want it in the pool for analysis later on. So I think just as there's going to be a lot of innovation around the Internet of Things, I think there's also a lot of opportunity for implementing privacy around the Internet of Things. And it begins with applying those principles, and data minimization at times will be a really useful one.
Okay. Jeff, and then Yale.
I think that one of the challenges with data minimization is not the easy cases, but it's the hard cases. So if I'm an individual developing an app, and down the line I think I might want to improve my app based upon that data, or I might want to create a variation of my app, a different app, but use someone's data, what am I supposed to make of the FTC staff report? And I think that's the concern, is what's the impact that we can't measure on people who read this report and don't understand, is this speaking for the commission? Is this a hint of enforcement cases to come? Am I liable here? And I think there's, you know, plenty of great things that are in the staff report, but that would be the troubling development from my perspective.
Okay, Yael?
When you look at the FTC staff report, when you see some of the headings and the concepts in there, in a way you can forget that you're reading an Internet of Things report and just think back to the FTC privacy report. So a lot of the same concepts, I think, are being applied in the Internet of Things. Rob, to your point about discovering new uses, I think that's one of the most important points to think about here. In one area in particular, like the Fitbit or you name your competitor, insert competitor name here, there may be inferences that will be discovered later on down the road. For example, how your sleep pattern impacts the number of steps you take, how that impacts your heart rate, how that impacts your food choices. And those types of things, I think, can be really valuable to consumers. It may not be a benefit that is being realized today, but I think that's something that it could be realized down the road. And I also want to make a plug here for big data analytics and the importance of continuing to fight for cross-border data flows, because if you think about data sets and the difficulties that some scientists have in getting data over from Europe on a lot of these issues because of the privacy and the skepticism about de-identification, in the Internet of Things, it's even more important.
So I want to... I really do want to come back to de-identification, but I want to go to one other point first, which is the security question. And clearly there are going to be cases where you can build in pretty good security as IoT. In other cases, there may be that you just really, it's just going to make the price point too high, and it's going to kind of, there are going to be a lot of really little cheap things. I mean, like 5-cent things, and you may not want to really build security into them, or you do the best you can. And then there are maybe other things where you're like, hey, I'm willing to pay a price premium for this. And so there's that. It seems to me there's that trade-off. I mean, I think, Brenda, you talked about the HP study. I mean, if you want to go to my house right now, you could break in pretty easily. I don't have Internet of Things. I have a thing called a lock and a window. And
where do you live, Rob?
The address is on Bing, so just feel free to go there. However, we do have a Doberman pincher. So there's that. I guess the question, that's sort of my first question, is should we think about a gradation of security? Some things are just going to have stronger security than others, and how do we think about that?
Right. Yeah, it was actually Mark that mentioned the report, but I think that security is obviously a key part of this. And as I alluded to before, and your lock example is a good one. It's like we have locks on our doors right now, and there are threats around that. Somebody might find a way to duplicate a key, or jam the lock, or get in the house another way, just because we're adding internet connectivity and an application to open your house remotely doesn't necessarily mean that it's introducing an entirely new threat. There's just a new channel for that threat. And so just as we've been talking about the need for privacy by design, this needs to be the security by design as well. And so it's about modeling that threat, working out where the weak points might be, and ensuring that's well protected. And I'm very optimistic there too. I think that we have the tool set. It's a constant effort of investment, I think, to really model out these threats and put the mitigations in place. But there are many useful ways to mitigate the threats. For example, I think a lot of these cheaper, smaller devices, let's just say in the home environment, for example, they don't necessarily all have to be internet connected themselves. They might connect to a local hub in the house or to your phone. And that communication from that device in close proximity to my smartphone might not have to be as secure as the connection from my phone back up to the cloud where the data gets stored and is available and analyzed and that sort of thing. So it's really looking at the whole thing end to end from the software layers and the hardware layers, and then modeling out the uses and thinking about where to mitigate and put the security protections in place.
Mark, did you want to add anything to that?
I completely agree. I mean, security definitely depends on a whole range of factors and, the sensitivity of the information at issue. And there's obviously some security that doesn't make sense. I'm thinking there was an article, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 months ago about an internet-connected light bulb, and there were issues where basically it wasn't authenticating to anybody's system, so anybody could just sort of like go up and interact with the light bulb. So you can say, well, who cares if somebody turns off my light bulb? Or you could look at it like, well, this could be my, the thing that I use to light up the back the back door, and if that's off, then, you know. But anyway, you always have to think through all those pros and cons.
Yeah.
One comment on that. I was on a panel a few months back, and someone provided this statistic. I have no idea if it's accurate or not. Brendan would probably be in the best position to advise us if it is. That if you're in the technology space handling data, 30% of your budget needs to be devoted to privacy and security. So we'll look at the annual report of Microsoft and see if that's the case. You may want to get a raise then.
I might use that, yeah.
So, this person made that statement and then said, well, how do you tell two guys in a garage that 30% of their budget, and I said, well, maybe it's two women in a garage. That was my initial statement. How do you tell two people in a garage that 30% of their budget when they're toying with some new device needs to go to privacy and security? And I think the response to that is that's what you say and that's what you do. And I think, Rob, you picked on a really good point. Security is proportionate to the nature of the data and its sensitivity. So not all data is created equal.
Yeah, we actually just issued a little report on sort of thinking about FTC enforcement around a sort of matrix of did you intend to do something bad and did it really cause harm? And I do think that, so if you're two women in a garage
doing something,
you don't intend to do anything bad, and you design a toaster where I can know your toast is going, and who the heck cares? You kind of get a little slap on the wrist maybe, but it does go back to this
thing.
Well,
if it's Passover, it's maybe a problem.
Pardon me?
If it's Passover.
That's true. You could be under the religious police for... Yeah, but no, that's we laugh about it, but look, the reality of the privacy debate in Washington is there are a not insignificant number of people at certain advocacy groups who say that my refrigerator, goddammit, has got to be completely secure and private. I fundamentally don't care. And my thought on that is, if the light bulb example, if somebody's puts out a light bulb that's easily hacked, then, no one's going to buy the light bulb. It'll be viral and people will not buy the light bulb. So I want to... One last thing on security, I want to go back to, is the Wyndham case the way we should think about this? So we were actually very supportive of what the FTC is doing in the Wyndham case. For those of you who don't know, by the way, I have no idea whether Wyndham's guilty or not. It's irrelevant to the point. But the FTC has brought a case against Wyndham under a Wyndham hotel chain under unfair and deceptive practice because they assert that Wyndham had bad security, which allowed a hacker to go in and get names of people when they stayed in hotels, which is sensitive information for some people. Is that sort of the right approach here, that we just, the companies that come out with bad security, we take them, FTC prosecutes them under unfair and deceptive practices?
Well, I'm happy to start. I think, I think effective enforcement is a key part of the trust framework, that we mentioned, that any bad actors or irresponsible actions, But I actually think the point you made earlier is probably just as relevant here too, which is the market forces. And if security is really bad, these two women in a garage learn that the hard way because people don't want to buy their products anymore, then for the next version, they might put a larger percent of their budget towards, getting it right. And so I think that's an interesting part of this too, is that in some ways the market will help to drive the right practices that we want here.
I think Target may have learned that lesson. Any other thoughts on that?
One point on that, which is one thing that I think the FTC does a really good job of, and one thing that I used to talk about a lot when I was at the FTC and would be traveling internationally, is it's consumer education, because in consumer education, you're also educating the people who end up in the garages. It's generating a culture of security, and the FTC does a really good job of that on an individual level as well, not just on a business level, having hotel records, but just individually, how to keep your own system secure.
So I want to go back to this point Brendan raised initially, which was on de-identification. And I'm struck constantly by this urban mythology that's been put out there that you can't de-identify data sets. And
We issued a report last year, co-authored by Anne Kavoukian, who at the time was the Ontario Privacy Commissioner, on why you can de-identify data and what the data science is around that, and why some of the common claims that people make or the cases they cite are really anomalous, not the norm. But Europe seems to have just sort of bought into this, and the people I've talked to over Europe, oh, there's no way you can, everything can be re-identified. And I guess I'd be curious, does anybody believe that, which case feel free to raise your hand, or do you think really you can de-identify data sets and the issue is really the right policy framework to make sure you do it right? Brendan, do you want to? I mean, I know you're Microsoft.
I think both. I can have a lot of sympathy with the argument that if you've got enough computing power and you've got enough data points, that you significantly increase the possibility of re-identifying de-identified data. So we should never think of it as an absolute. But I think it's extremely valuable as a risk mitigation tool. Mm-hmm. And that's the way we should think about it. It would be a shame to sort of throw it out because there's this theoretical possibility and perhaps actual possibility that something could be re-identified because it can actually reduce risk. And that's, I think, what it's all about, is how can we raise the barrier for somebody to re-identify data rather than trying to strive for some absolute.
Mark, do you, would Steph, you agree with that point?
Yeah, I mean, basically I do. I mean, on one hand, there's the research, they periodically put these out about location data that you basically need to know like 3 points of location data to conclusively identify whatever some massive percentage of people. But at the same time, and the Netflix example was another one where they disclosed a large data set of people's viewing, like movie selections and so forth, and researchers were able to reconstruct whose choices those.
That was because there were a number of other data points with that. It wasn't just movies. It wasn't
right.
Other
yeah.
things that were.
Yeah. But so at the same time, I kind of feel like there are probably limits with most data sets to how much somebody would actually want to, perform that kind of de-analysis. So I wouldn't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good.
Okay.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I think there's an element of reasonableness into the ability to re-identify, and that's something we obviously advocate for. Another thing to be mindful of is who is the party that has the data that has been de-identified, and obviously there may be some entity out there that could still re-identify, but we're talking about a different entity at this stage. So I think we need to be mindful of that, who holds the key, and I think de-identification is a significant risk mitigation tool, and it shouldn't be dismissed.
Yeah, I would argue, actually, I'm a little stronger all on it than you are, because I think there's a lot of cases of bad de-identification where you put too many variables, PI variables, together. But let's just say we had everybody fills out a survey here, and you put in your age, your sex, and your birthday, your sex, and what medications you're taking. If all I know are two things, sex and medication, I have a 1 in 70 chance of correctly picking you. Now, if you add in birthday, I probably have a 1 in 3 chance or 1 in 1 chance of correctly picking you. So I do think that I go with Brendan. It's a partly risk. I mean, some of this, you look at what HHS is doing. They have a number of data scientists who look at these protocols for analyzing health sets and really say you can use these data sets, these variables or not. So I think it's getting that oversight, getting more sophistication with those things so that we can use it properly. So I want to raise one last issue before we open it up, and that's this issue of FIPS, Fair Information Privacy Practices. FIPS is sort of one of these 1970s concepts, which doesn't mean it's not valid now. But there have been some pushback that, can you really get notice when you don't have a screen? Do you really want access? Can you really ask for your access to your data when it's 400 million data points? I need to know all 100 million bumps I went over last year. I mean, so how do we think about FIPS in this context, Brendan?
As I said at the beginning, I think that they're a really good starting point for determining what's different or whether they can still work in the Internet of Things age. And generally, I say yes, they can. But there'll be some pressures and tensions on them. So you mentioned, for example, privacy notices. You know, so the transparency principle, the way it's been traditionally implemented in just the website sort of world, is you have a privacy statement, and those things are getting longer and longer as the websites get more interactive and there's more to explain, right? But you're right, we've got a volume issue with Internet of Things. We also have a screen size issue in that many of these devices won't have a user interface necessarily for you to view that 47-page privacy statement. So we're going to need to innovate on that too. We're going to need to innovate with, I think, more in-context notice where there is a sensitive data collection or use that there's something in the user interface that indicates that, and if there are controls associated with it, that's there. One of the things we might need to innovate, for example, on is how do we, if there are sensors in my environment that are essentially invisible to me because they're so small, how can I be aware of their presence? Is there a way for them to broadcast their presence and some place for me to go to if I do want to find out more? You know, so that's an example of where I think it doesn't mean that the FIPS are useless. It just means that they need to be applied in a different way given the scenario.
Okay. Mark?
So I guess to me, I divide the Internet of Things into two groups, sort of. There's the consumer-facing Internet of Things, which is what our report was about, where I'm going to go out and buy, you mentioned you have a Nest and Microsoft Band or whatever it may be. And then there's the sort of the Internet of Things that isn't really here yet, which is all these sensors that might be placed by governments or whatever to monitor traffic or this kind of thing. And for the consumer-directed products, I don't really see a lot of challenges to notice and choice. I mean, yeah, it's true you don't have a screen on all these devices, but when you ordered your Nest, you bought it probably from a website and you could have been given information, you could have been given a novel in that process. And you got a box that had this thing in it, and you could have opened the box and found the privacy policy in there. So some of this, I think, is overblown for our current products. I think where it gets more interesting is, like Brennan said, where there may be collections going on that you're not even aware of, like facial recognition devices that you're walking by, and you don't even know that, all you see is a camera. You don't even know what's going on. So that's where I think the challenges are, but that's sort of a world that's not really quite here yet.
Okay. So I want to open it up for questions, but so think about your question. Before I do that, I want to turn to Jeff. Jeff, any prognostication of sort of where Congress, or particularly the Senate, since the Senate better, where they're going in this space, more hearings to learn more, or what do you see happening?
Sure. So I think that the hearing that we had was really an entry point into this topic, and it could be that we will examine component parts of it down the line, and that may take place in various subcommittees and whatnot. I think that we should all be encouraged by the passage of the resolution that you mentioned, which was introduced by Senators Ayotte, Fisher, Booker, and Schatz. And the big takeaway that I have from that resolution is that you now have the Senate on record, A, talking about the great promise that this technology holds, but B, calling for a strategy on IoT that is not a regulatory, top-down approach. And so I think that's important. It's mm-hmm. important to note that, to me, both the committee and the Senate as a whole want to take a wait-and-see approach and give this technology time to mature. And if there are discrete harms, as Senator Heller mentioned, we can talk about how to address those. But overreacting will have the tendency to stifle a lot of the things that we hope to gain from the technology.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Comments or questions? Yes, sir. Yeah.
Hi, Rob. Dan Caprio. Great panel. McKenna Long and Aldridge. To pick up on your point, I mean, it's very encouraging that the House and Senate or Commerce Committees have been having hearings on the Internet of Things. And what we see, I think, is, it really is about innovation. I mean, it's privacy and security, it's spectrum, it's standards. But I think the work points out, excuse me, we really need a national strategy. This is about, you know, global, our ability in the U.S. to compete in the global marketplace. And my fear is that, you know, we've got right now, we've got a siloed approach. We've got it's going on at Department of Energy, it's going on at Department of Transportation, it's going on at NIST, the independent agencies. So I think without a national strategy, we're going to get left in the dust. And so I'd be interested in you know, people's comments about how we actually take the work that's been done in the Senate and make it real.
Well, I should note that the resolution calls for a strategy. It's silent as to who or what will end up writing that strategy. But certainly there were witnesses at our committee hearing that thought that a strategy of sorts would be beneficial, and that other countries had already gone down that road, and perhaps we should catch up, so to speak. And so perhaps you'll get your wish shortly.
I do think this is actually an area where a national strategy could play a very important role, because there are so many intersection points between what government is doing and IoT applications. So the Department of Energy, Department of Transportation, HUD, Interior, NOAA. I mean, it's just everybody's in the space, and IoT could help the performance of government all across the board. But there really is no central place in the government now in the administration thinking that. There's sort of bits and pieces of it. So. Yes, sir.
Yeah, a quick point to Robert, just a point of information. The study you mentioned, Kevorkian and Castro, about de-identification, there was a rebuttal from Narayanan and Felton at Princeton that took it on point by point and might be worth reviewing. A question from the FTC. You got an FTC broker's report that mentions 3,000 data points on pretty much every American. Can you describe what those data points might be and how they enter into re-identification issues?
Well, I would point people to read the report, but there was a lot of discussion of, for example, the categories that people are put into by data brokers for marketing purposes. I was talking just the other day, I had a meeting one time with a data broker, and they said that they were able, through analysis of the information they had, to identify people who are basically about to get divorced. And they said that, well, you know, we don't use this information because it's not valuable to us. But I was thinking of all the, you know, divorce lawyers and real estate agents and moving companies and other stuff who actually might want to use that information. So the report sort of tried to shed a light based on we obtained data through our Section 6B authority to get information for reporting purposes and not for investigative purposes. And so I would just encourage everybody to read that report.
I would just add, we've read that response, Felton's response, and disagreed with it just as much as he disagreed with ours, and happy to put you in touch with Daniel Castor, who can give you our response to his response. Dueling de-identification strategies, go.
Early on, Rob Hett, you had referenced kind of the two core underlying uses. So there's analysis and delivery. So small amounts of data used for delivery of a service, large amounts used for analysis. From the government's or the public sector's perspective, where does that strategy, or companies like Microsoft or big research institutions like NIST, what role do they play in providing confidence to maybe a smaller, a local government, a city, or even a state in terms of when to deliver a service or when to not deliver a service? When does a certain amount of data trigger a threshold that says, I should send a fire truck or I should not send a fire truck? Those types of liability issues are of great concern to a government that might not know when it should take action based on these devices.
That's a really interesting question that people are going to struggle with for a while. Brendan?
I think each of these scenarios is going to obviously need to be treated separately. And you know, in that situation, it's the users of the data and the providers of the services that will ultimately need to make those judgment calls as to what data points, you know, trigger is the right trigger for them. You know, I'm not sure how much it's down to the device makers or the data platform operators and things. It's going to be, I think, in those scenarios, down to the use cases.
Just to react to that, if you think through that, it sounds like you're thinking through things like, when do you send the fire truck? When do you send the gas company? We detect a gas leak. When do you send social services? Because we think there may be a problem. When do you send a suicide counselor? So those sorts of issues, those are four very different scenarios, and those need to be thought of thoughtfully, not only with us, but certainly with people with other degrees at the end of their names. And I agree that it's not necessarily something that the device makers would be determining on their own.
I mean, it seemed to me the real question is, when do you send the lawyers in to sue the city? but more seriously, it does suggest, though, that I mean, this is why we need to really beef up the discipline of data science. And we need more data scientists. I mean, there's no reason cities couldn't have their own data scientists. There's no reason why something like the National League of Cities or the National Police Association. I mean, I think ultimately we'll sort of get there, but we'll just sort of have to develop a lot of different statistic-based learning out of it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it'll be working together. I was just thinking of the scenario of an automobile accident, you know, and there's probably a threshold where, you know, a certain degree of impact would trigger, you know, the need to send emergency services straight away versus making a call to see if people are okay or whatever it may be. And so it's probably going to be take it scenario by scenario, work out where the core value is to the individual or society, and then what needs to be built in to enable that.
Are there no other questions, no other comments? Yes, sir. You want to hold on for the mic?
Rob, you mentioned that we should wait on legislation, not rush to it. But according to IDC, there's going to be 212 billion internet devices by 2020. And I'm thinking if we wait to have standardization around devices and practical password policies, for example, last year 73,000 internet cameras were hacked because of bad passwords. I mean, those are simple things that we can do today in order for us not to be behind the ball, the eight ball, a few years from now.
Jeff?
My reaction is that interoperability is clearly a huge issue here, but I'm not so sure that it's an issue that the government needs to tackle. I mean, the internet in general, there are all sorts of standards out there. The internet's a pretty fantastic thing, and we've seen.
NIST or?
I'm sorry?
NIST?
I think I'll just say government generally, I think, can refrain for the time being, and I think let's see how interoperability is tackled. I mean, we've got a pretty good success story so far, and so. I think we have a reason for optimism that even in IoT, that the private sector can handle this.
So actually, that's a good segue because I wanted to bring this up with the AL. I was in Beijing last summer and talking with officials, and they had this notion that they needed their own Chinese Internet of Things standards, which, to give them the benefit of the doubt, they perhaps don't understand the global IoT system. To be less generous, they wanted to build a mercantilist IoT system to keep out foreign IoT. Can you talk a little bit about how you see the global standards space happening in this and why that might be a bad idea?
That'll be alongside the Chinese internet, right?
Exactly, you know, right? Exactly.
You know, I'll sort of end with the way that I started, which is that privacy and security are important considerations in the Internet of Things, but in order to fully realize the benefits, there are going to be very intense standard types discussions and a lot of public-private partnerships in this area to ensure interoperability, compatibility. We already face scenarios where one thing doesn't talk to another effectively, not just amongst ourselves, but in devices, and I think that's what we want to try to avoid in the Internet of Things.
Yeah, I think what I would add, I think, to Jeff's point, there's standards, there's actually standards efforts around the Internet of Things, which will be really helpful here. The All Join, the All Seen Alliance, which is a privacy professional, I think, is an unfortunate name, All Seen, but but it's a collection of 140 so far organizations, including Microsoft, working on these standards not only for interoperability to enable devices to talk to each other, but also the security protocols and the like. And that I think will be, you know, is a really useful place for industry self-regulation to occur, to some extent on these things. And so the scenario I mentioned earlier of the ability for devices to talk to each other in close proximity, that actually can play a role in reducing the surface area for privacy and security risk. And so it's that's an example of how the industry can come together and make this not only work better, but deal with some of the security challenges at the same time.
I would just briefly note that some of these interoperability challenges in a lot of ways are a good problem to have, because it's evidence that within the IoT system you have enterprises of all sizes and backgrounds that are coming up with exciting technologies, and it will ultimately end up being a strength of the system.
Okay, great. Okay, we'll go here and then we'll go here. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much for being here today. This has been a great conversation. My name is David. I work with Deloitte Consulting on privacy and data protection with federal and financial services clients. I had a question kind of around the next generation workforce. One of the things that we're seeing is a lot of, you know, BYOD, flexible work arrangements, a commingling of business and personal data on enterprise and personal devices. I wanted to ask about kind of a generational shift when it comes to privacy. Do you feel like kind of this next gen workforce kind of has different ideas when it comes to privacy, people who have lived their entire lives online, whether or not they're as concerned maybe about privacy issues as some of us might be, and kind of how you see that perhaps impacting, you know, privacy decisions in the future?
Brendan, you, I'm sure, have studied this.
I think there is a myth out there that young people don't care about privacy. And because look at the evidence of how much they're sharing online. And I think that for them, what's happening, though, is that the definition of privacy is perhaps shifting. You know, older generations have thought of it maybe in terms of secrecy. This new generation, you know, thinks of it in terms of control. You know, the sharing is controlled. I get to decide who gets to see this post or this profile and whatever it may be. And I think that will extend as they, you know, come into the workforce. Those similar expectations will be there, that they have the ability to first of all use all the cool technologies and to be able to collaborate in ways that are very rich and broad, but also have a degree of control over that. And so we'll probably see the need for what we see in the consumer space kind of spills over to what is needed in the employment context as well.
And then the last question, Adam.
Hi, I'm Adam Thierm with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. I wanted to go back to something that Yale said earlier and applaud the fact that she brought up education as something that needs to be included in this discussion. All too often we talk about all the sort of legalistic or regulatory-based approaches to addressing these tricky issues, particularly revolving around privacy. But privacy, or the lack of respect for it, is really more of a social or cultural problem that we'll never really get our heads around unless we find a way to educate kids and innovators and everybody else. Toward that end, I'm wondering what more we should be doing. I was a little bit distressed that the FTC report only mentioned education as an afterthought and didn't even bother mentioning the wonderful work that the FTC does with OnGuard Online to educate consumers and innovators about smart steps they can take to better protect their privacy. What more than that could or should be done? Fordham University had a major program 2 years ago on a voluntary privacy educators program to educate kids, not just in their capacity as consumers of information, but as producers of information and the next generation of innovators. Wonderful curricula they put together. As far as I can tell, nobody in the government's even aware of it or even does anything like this. Who or what should be done to sort of facilitate privacy education as a solution here to these IoT problems?
Anybody? Mark?
Well, I would just say that, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on consumer and business education. And when we released the IoT report, we at the same time released a business education piece with it. And we put out pieces on mobile app security and mobile app developers advice and things like that. So we do think it's important. A part of the puzzle, I mean, I think it's personally a relatively small part compared to some of the other things, but I think it is a part of it. And it's part of, you know, again, educating people about privacy by design and security by design. And I would say that, as you mentioned, the government is obviously not the only source of information. You can go to a lot of other resources and find all you would ever want to read out there about with good advice on this.
Okay. Well, great. So if you could all The last closing comment, just give us your social security number.
Truncated.
So there's a 3 in mine. So that means you probably should be able to identify it if you use a powerful enough computer. With that, this was a great panel and really interesting insights and observations. So thank you for all attending, and please join me in thanking the great panel.